and the ominous silence afterward. But I have my own problems to deal with in this particular moment. Remhua, he of the quickest wit, slaps us from our shock with the realization that something else is controlling the engine. No time to wonder who or why. Gehua perceives how and signals frantically. The 27 offline fragments are still active. In fact, they have formed a kind of subnetwork, a spare key. This is how the other presence has managed to dislodge the Onyx's control. Now all of the fragments, which generate and contain the bulk of the plutonic engine's power, are under hostile foreign control. I am a proud creature at my core. This is intolerable. The Onyx was given to me to hold, and so I seize it again and shove it back into the connections that comprise the engine, dislodging the false control at once. Salehua slams down the shockwaves of magic that this violent disruption causes, lest they ricochet through the engine and touch off a resonance that will... Well, we don't actually know what such resonance would do, but it would be bad. I hold on throughout the reverberations of this, my teeth bared back in the real world, listening while my siblings cry out or snarl with me or gasp amid the aftershocks of the initial upheaval. Everything is confusion. In the realm of flesh and blood, the lights of our chambers have gone out, leaving only emergency panels to glow around the edges of the room.
The warning klaxons are incessant, and elsewhere in Zero Sight, I can hear equipment snapping and rattling with the overload that we have put into the system.
The conductors, screaming in the observation chamber, cannot help us. Not that they ever could. I don't know what's happening. Not really. I know only that this is a battle, full of moment-to-moment confusion, as all battles are. And from here forth, nothing is quite clear. That strange presence that has attacked us pulls hard against the plutonic engine, trying to dislodge our control once more. I shout at it in wordless geyser boil magma crack fury. Get out of here, I rage. Leave us alone. You started this, it hisses into the strata, trying again. When this fails, however, it snarls in frustration and then locks instead into those 27 fragments that have gone so mysteriously offline. Dushwa senses the hostile entity's intent and tries to grasp some of the 27, but the fragments slip through their grasp as if coated with oil. This is true enough, figuratively speaking. Something has contaminated these fragments, leaving them fouled and nearly impossible to grasp. We might manage it with concerted effort one by one, but there is no time. And until then, the enemy holds the 27. Stalemate. We still hold the Onyx. We hold the other 229 fragments, which are ready to fire the feedback pulse that will destroy Sylanagis and ourselves. We've postponed that, however, because we cannot leave matters like this. Where did this entity, so angry and phenomenally powerful, come from? What will it do with the obelisks that it holds? Long moments pass in pent silence. I cannot speak for the others, but I at least begin to think there will be no further attacks. I have always been such a fool. Into the silence comes the amused, malicious challenge of our enemy, ground forth in magic and iron and stone. Burn for me, says Father Earth. I must speculate on some of what follows, even after all these ages spent seeking answers. I can narrate no more, because in the moment everything was nigh instantaneous and confusing and devastating. The Earth changes only gradually, until it doesn't. And when it fights back, it does so decisively. Here is the context. That first test bore that initiated the Geo-Arcanity Project also alerted the Earth to humanity's efforts to take control of it. Over the decades that followed, it studied its enemy and began to understand what we meant to do. Metal was its instrument and ally. Never trust metal for this reason. It sent splinters of itself to the surface to examine the fragments in their sockets. For here, at least, was life stored in crystal, comprehensible to an entity of inorganic matter in a way that mere flesh was not.
Only gradually did it learn how to take control of individual human lives, though it required the medium of the core stones to do so. We are such small, hard-to-grasp creatures otherwise, such insignificant vermin, apart from our unfortunate tendency to sometimes make ourselves dangerously significant. The obelisks, though, were a more useful tool, easy to turn back on us, like any carelessly held weapon. Burn down. Remember Alia. Imagine the disaster times 256. Imagine the stillness perforated at every nodal point and seismically active site. And the ocean, too. Hundreds of hotspots and gas pockets and oil reservoirs breached, and the entire plate tectonic system destabilized. There is no word for such a catastrophe. It would liquefy the surface of the planet, vaporizing the oceans and sterilizing everything from the mantle up. The world for us and any possible creature that might ever evolve in the future to hurt the Earth would end. The Earth itself would be fine, however. We could stop it, if we wanted to. I will not say we weren't tempted when faced with the choice between permitting the destruction of a civilization or of all life on the planet. Silanagist's fate was sealed. Make no mistake, we had meant to seal it. The difference between what the Earth wanted and what we wanted was merely a matter of scale. But which is the way the world ends? We tuners would be dead. The distinction mattered little to me in that moment. It's never wise to ask such a question of people who have nothing to lose. Except, I did have something to lose. In those eternal instants, I thought of Kalinli and her child. Thus it was that my will took precedence within the network. If you have any doubt, I'll say it plainly now. I am the one who chose the way the world ended. I am the one who took control of the plutonic engine. We could not stop burndown, but we could insert a delay into the sequence and redirect the worst of its energy. After the Earth's tampering, the power was too volatile to simply pour back into Silanagist as we'd originally planned. That would have done the Earth's work for us. That much kinetic force had to be expended somewhere. Nowhere on the planet, if I meant for humanity to survive. But here were the moon and the moonstone, ready and waiting. I was in a hurry. There was no time to second guess. The power could not reflect from the moonstone as it was meant to. That would only increase the power of burndown. Instead, with a snarl as I grabbed the others and forced them to help me, they were willing, just slow. We shattered the moonstone cabochon. In the next instant, the power struck the broken stone, failed to reflect, and began to chew its way through the moon. Even with this to mitigate the blow, the force of impact was devastating in itself. More than enough to slam the moon out of orbit. The backlash of misusing the engine this way should have simply killed us. But the Earth was still there, the ghost in the machine. As we writhed in our death throes, all of Zero's sight crumbling apart around us, it took control again. I have said that it held us responsible for the attempt on its life, and it did. But somehow, perhaps through its years of study, it understood that we were tools of others, not actors of our own volition. Remember, too, that the Earth does not fully understand us.
It looks upon human beings and sees short-lived, fragile creatures, puzzlingly detached in substance and awareness from the planet on which their lives depend, who do not understand the harm they try to do. Perhaps because they are so short-lived and fragile and detached. And so it chose for us what seemed to it a punishment leavened with meaning. It made us part of it. In my wire chair, I screamed as wave upon wave of alchemy worked over me, changing my flesh into raw, living, solidified magic that looks like stone. We didn't get the worst of it. That was reserved for those who had offended the earth the most. It used the core stone fragments to take direct control of these most dangerous vermin. But this did not work as it intended. Human will is harder to anticipate than human flesh. They were never meant to continue. I will not describe the shock and confusion I felt in those first hours after my change. I will not ever be able to answer the question of how I returned to Earth from the moon. I remember only a nightmare of endless falling and burning, which may have been delirium. I will not ask you to imagine how it felt to suddenly find oneself alone and tuneless after a lifetime spent singing to others like myself. This was justice. I accept it. I admit my crimes. I have sought to make up for them. But, well, what's done is done. In those last moments before we transformed, we did successfully manage to cancel the burn-down command to the 229. Some fragments were shattered by the stress. Others would die over the subsequent millennia, their matrices disrupted by incomprehensible arcane forces. Most went into standby mode to continue drifting for millennia over a world that no longer needed their power, until, on occasion, one of the fragile creatures below might send a confused, directionless request for access. We could not stop the Earth's 27. We did, however, manage to insert a delay into their command lattices. 100 years. What the tales get wrong is only the timing, you see. 100 years after Father Earth's child was stolen from him, 27 obelisks did burn down to the planet's core, leaving fiery wounds all over its skin. It was not the cleansing fire that the Earth sought, but it was still the first and worst fifth season, what you call the shattering. Humankind survives, because 100 years is nothing to the Earth, or even to the expanse of human history. But to those who survived the fall of Syl Anagist, it was just time enough to prepare. The moon, bleeding debris from a wound through its heart, vanished over a period of days. And I never saw Kalinli or her child again. Too ashamed of the monster I'd become, I never sought them out. She lived, though. Now and again, I heard the grind and grumble of her stone voice, and those of her several children as they were born. They were not wholly alone. With the last of their majestic technology, the survivors of Syl Anagist decanted a few more tuners and used them to build shelters, contingencies, systems of warning and protection. Those tuners died in time, however, as their usefulness ended, or as others blamed them for the Earth's wrath. Only Kalenli's children, who did not stand out, whose strength hid in plain sight, continued. Only Kalenli's legacy, in the form of the lorists, who went from settlement to settlement, warning of the coming Holocaust, and teaching others how to cooperate, adapt, and remember, remains of the Nies. It all worked, though. You survive? That was my doing, too, isn't it? I did my best, helped where I could. And now, my love, we have a second chance. Time for you to end the world again. 2501. Fault line shift along the minimal maximal. Massive. Shockwave swept through half the Nomidlats and Arctics, but stopped at outer edge of equatorial node network. Food prices rose sharply following year, but famine prevented. Project notes of Yater Innovator D-Bars. 13. Nasun and Esun on the dark side of the world. It's sunset when Nasun decides to change the world. She has spent the day curled beside Shafa, using his still ash-flecked old clothes as a pillow, breathing his scent, and wishing for things that cannot be. Finally she gets up and very carefully feeds him the last of the vegetable broth she has made. She gives him a lot of water, too. Even after she has dragged the moon into a collision course, it will take a few days for the earth to be smashed apart. She doesn't want Shafa to suffer too much in that time, since she will no longer be around to help him. She is such a good child at her core. Don't be angry with her. She can only make choices within the limited set of her experiences. And it isn't her fault that so many of those experiences have been terrible. Marvel, instead, at how easily she loves, how thoroughly. Love enough to change the world. She learned how to love like this from somewhere. As she uses a cloth to dab spilled broth from her lips, she reaches up and begins activation of her network. Here at Core Point, she can do it without even the Onyx. But startup will take time. A commandment is set in stone, she tells Shafa solemnly. His eyes are open again. He blinks, perhaps in reaction to the sound, though she knows this is meaningless. The words are a thing she read in the strange handwritten book, the one that told her how to use a smaller network of obelisks as a spare key to subvert the Onyx's power over the gate. The man who wrote the book was probably crazy, as evidenced by the fact that he apparently loved Nasun's mother long ago. That is strange and wrong, and yet somehow unsurprising. As big as the world is, Nasun is beginning to realize it's also really small. The same stories cycling around and around, the same endings again and again, the same mistakes eternally repeated. Some things are too broken to be fixed, Shafa. Inexplicably, she thinks of Jija. The ache of this silences her for a moment. I can't make anything better, but I can at least make sure the bad things stop. With that, she gets up to leave. She does not see Shafa's face turn like the moon sliding into shadow to watch her go. It's dawn when you decide to change the world. You're still asleep in the bedroll that Lerna has brought up to the roof of the Yellow X building. You and he spent the night under the water tower, listening to the ever-present rumble of the rifting and the snap of occasional lightning strikes. Probably should have had sex there one more time. But you didn't think about it, and he didn't suggest. So, oh well. That's gotten you into enough trouble anyway. Had no business relying solely on middle age and starvation for birth control. He watches you as you stand and stretch, and it's a thing you'll never fully understand or be comfortable with, the admiration in his gaze. He makes you feel like a better person than you are. And this is what makes you regret, again, endlessly, that you cannot stay to see his child born. Lerna's steady, relentless goodness is a thing that should be preserved in the world somehow. Alas, you haven't earned his admiration, but you intend to. You head downstairs and stop. Last night, in addition to Lerna, you let Tonki and Hyorka and Yika know that it was time, that you would leave after breakfast in the morning. You left the question of whether they could come with you or not open, and unstated. If they volunteer, it's one thing, but you're not going to ask. What kind of person would you be to pressure them into that kind of danger? There'll be in enough, just like the rest of humanity as it is. You weren't counting on finding all of them in the lobby of the Yellow X building as you come downstairs. All of them, busy tucking away bedrolls and yawning and frying sausages and complaining loudly about somebody drinking up all the rusting tea. Hoa is there, perfectly positioned to see you come downstairs. There's a rather smug smile on his stone lips, but that doesn't surprise you. Danil and Mashish do, the former up and doing some kind of martial exercises in a corner, while the latter dices another potato for the pan. And yes, he's built a campfire in the building lobby, because that's what calmless people do sometimes. Some of the windows are broken, the smoke's going out through them. Kyaka and Tonki are a surprise, too. They're still asleep, curled together in a pile of furs. But you really, really weren't expecting Yika to walk in, with an air of something like her old brashness, and with her eye makeup perfectly applied once again. She looks around the lobby, taking you in along with the rest, and puts her hands on her hips. Catch you rastas at a bad time? You can't, you blurt. It's hard to talk, not in your throat. Yika, especially, you stare at her. Evil Earth, she's wearing her fur vest again. You thought she'd left that behind in Kostrima Under. You can't come, the calm. Yika rolls her dramatically decorated eyes. Well, fuck you too. But you're right, I'm not coming. Just here to see you off, along with whoever goes with you. I really should be having you killed since you were effectively ashing yourselves out, but I suppose we can overlook that little technicality for now. What? We can't come back? Tonki blurts. She's sitting up, finally, though at a distinct lean and with her hair badly askew. Kyarka, muttering imprecations about being awake, has gotten up and handed her a plate of potato hash from the pile Mashish has already cooked. Yika eyes her. You? You are traveling to an enormous, perfectly preserved obelisk builder ruin. I'll never see you again. But sure, I suppose you could come back. If Yaka manages to drag you to your senses, I need her at least. Mashish yawns loudly enough to draw everyone's attention. He's naked, which lets you see that he's looking better at last, still nearly skeletal. But that's half the calm these days. He's coughing less, though, and his hair is starting to grow fuller, although so far it's only at that hilarious bottle brush stage before ashblow hair develops enough weight to flop decently. It's the first time you've seen his leg stumps unclothed, and you belatedly realize the scars are far too neat to have been done by some calmless raider with a hacksaw. Well, that's his story to tell. You say to him, "Don't be stupid." Mashish looks mildly annoyed. I'm not going, no, but I could be. No, you rasting couldn't, Yika snaps. I already told you, we need a fulcrum roga here. He sighs. Fine, but no reason I can't at least see you off. Now stop asking questions and come get some food. He reaches for his clothes and starts to pull them on. You obediently go over to the fire to eat something. No morning sickness yet. That's a bit of luck. As you eat, you watch everyone and find yourself overwhelmed and also a little frustrated. Of course, it's touching that they've come like this to say goodbye. You're glad of it. You can't even pretend otherwise. When have you ever left a place this way? Openly, non-violently, amid laughter? It feels... You don't know how it feels. Good? You don't know what to do with that. You hope more of them decide to stay behind, though. As it is, Hoa's going to be hauling a rusting caravan through the earth. But when you eye Danil, you blink in surprise. She's cut her hair again. really doesn't seem to like it long. Fresh shaving on the sides and black tint on her lips. Earth knows where she found it. Or maybe she made it herself out of charcoal and fat. But it's suddenly hard to see her as the strong-back general she was. Wasn't. It changes things somehow. To understand that you go to face a fate that an equatorial lorist wants to record for posterity. Now it's not just a caravan. It's a rusting quest. The thought pulls a snort laugh out of you, and everyone pauses in what they're doing to stare. Nothing, you say, waving a hand and setting the empty plate aside. Just... shit. Come on, then, whoever's coming. Someone's brought Lerna his pack, which he dons quietly, watching you. Tomki curses and starts rushing to get herself together, while Hjarka patiently helps. Danil uses a rag to mop sweat from her face. You go over to Hoa, who has shaped his expression into one of wry amusement, and stand beside him to sigh at the mess. Can you bring this many?
As long as they remain in contact with me, or someone who's touching me, yes.
Sorry. I wasn't expecting this.
Weren't you?
You look at him, but then Tomki, still chewing something and shouldering her pack with her good arm, grabs his upraised hand, though she pauses to blatantly stare at it in fascination. The moment passes.
So, how's this supposed to work?
Ika paces the room, watching everyone and folding her arms. She's noticeably more restless than usual.
You get there, grab the moon, shove it into position, and then what? Will we see any sign of the change?
The rifting will go cold, you say. That won't change much in the short term, because there's too much ash in the air already. This season will have to play itself out, and it's going to be bad no matter what. The moon might even make things worse. You can sense it pulling on the world already.
Yeah, you're pretty sure it'll make things worse. Ika nods, though.
She can sense it, too. But there's a long-term loose end that you haven't been able to figure out yourself.
If I can do it, though.
Restore the moon. You shrug helplessly and look at Hoa.
It opens room for negotiation, he says in his hollow voice.
Everyone pauses to stare at him. By the flinches, you can tell who's used to stone eaters and who isn't.
And perhaps a truce.
Ika grimaces.
Perhaps? So we've gone through all this, and you can't even be sure if it will stop the seasons, evil Earth.
No, you admit. But it will stop this season. That much you're sure of. That much alone is worth it. Ika subsides, but she keeps muttering to herself now and again. This is how you know she wants to go too, but you're very glad she seems to have talked herself out of it. Kastrima needs her. You need to know that Kastrima will be here after you're gone. Finally, everyone is ready. You take Hoa's right hand with your left. You've got no other arm to spare for Lerna, so he wraps an arm around your waist. When you glance at him, he nods, steady, determined. On Hoa's other side are Tomki and Hjarka and Danil, chain-linked hand to hand.
This is going to blow, isn't it?
Hjarka asks. She alone looks nervous of the set. Danil's radiating calm, at peace with herself at last. Tomki's so excited she can't stop grinning. Lerna's just leaning on you, rock steady the way he always is.
Probably, Tomki says, bouncing a little. This seems like a spectacularly bad idea, Ika says.
She's leaned against a wall of the room, arms folded, watching the group assemble.
Essie's got to go, I mean, but the rest of you.
She shakes her head.
Would you be coming, if you weren't head woman?
Lerna asks. It's quiet. He always drops his biggest rocks like that, quietly and out of nowhere.
She scowls and glares at him, then throws you a look that's wary and maybe a little embarrassed before she sighs and pushes away from the wall. You saw, though. The lump is back in your throat.
Hey,
you say before she can flee. Yeek. She glares at you.
I hate that rusting nickname.
You ignore this.
You told me a while back that you had a stash of Siretis. We were supposed to get drunk after I beat the Renanus army, remember?
Yeeka blinks, and then a slow smile spreads across her face.
You were in a coma or something. I drank it all myself.
You glare at her, surprised to find yourself honestly annoyed. She laughs in your face. So much for tender farewells. But, well, it feels good anyway.
Close your eyes, Hoa says.
He's not joking, you add in warning. You keep yours open, though, as the world goes dark and strange. You feel no fear. You are not alone. It's nighttime. Nasun stands on what she thinks of as Corpoint's town green. It isn't. A city built before the seasons would have no need of such a thing. It's just a place near the enormous hole that is Corpoint's heart. Around the hole are strangely slanted buildings, like the pylons she saw in Sil Energist. But these ones are huge, stories high and a block wide apiece. She's learned that when she gets too near these buildings, which don't have any doors or windows that she can see, it sets off warnings composed of bright red words and symbols, several feet high apiece, which blaze in the air over the city. Worse are the low, blatting alarm sounds that echo through the streets. Not loud, but insistent, and they make her teeth feel loose and itchy. She's looked into the hole despite all this. It's enormous compared to the one that was in the underground city. Many times that one's circumference, so big that it would take her an hour or more to walk all the way around it. Yet for all its grandeur, despite the evidence it offers of feats of engineering long lost to humankind, Nasun cannot bring herself to be impressed by it. The hole feeds no one, provides no shelter against ash or assault. It doesn't even scare her, though that is meaningless. After her journey through the underground city in the core of the world, after losing Shafa, nothing will ever frighten her again. The spot Nasun has found is a perfectly circular patch of ground just beyond the hole's warning radius. It's odd ground, slightly soft to the touch and springy beneath her feet, not like any material she's ever touched before. But here in Corpoint, that sort of experience isn't rare. There's no actual soil in this circle, aside from a bit of wind-blown stuff piled up along the edges of the circle. A few seagrasses have taken root here. And there's the desiccated, spindly trunk of a dead sapling that did its best before being blown over many years before. That's all. A number of stone-eaters have appeared around the circle. She notes as she takes up position at its center. No sign of steel, but there must be 20 or 30 others on street corners or in buildings, sitting on stairs, leaning against walls. A few turned their heads or eyes to watch as she passed, but she ignored and ignores them. Perhaps they have come to witness history. Maybe some are like steel, hoping for an end to their horrifyingly endless existence. Maybe the ones who've helped her have done so because of that. Maybe they're just bored. Not the most exciting town, Corpoint. Nothing matters right now, except the night sky. And in that sky, the moon is beginning to rise. It sits low on the horizon, seemingly bigger than it was the night before, and made oblong by the distortions of the air. White and strange and round, it hardly seems worth all the pain and struggle that its absence has symbolized for the world. And yet, it pulls on everything within Nasun that is Orogen. It pulls on the whole world. Time for the world, then, to pull back.
Nasum shuts her eyes. They are all around Core Point now. The spare key. 3 by 3 by 3. 27 obelisks that she has spent the past few weeks touching and taming and coaxing into orbit nearby. She can still feel the sapphire, but it is far away and not in sight. She can't use it, and it would take months to arrive if she summoned it. These others will do, though. It's strange to see so many of the things in the sky all together after a lifetime with only one or no obelisks in sight at any given time. Stranger to feel them all connected to her, thrumming at slightly different speeds, their wells of power each at slightly different depths. The darker ones are deeper, no telling why, but it is a noticeable difference. Nasun lifts her hands, splaying her fingers in unconscious imitation of her mother. Very carefully, she begins connecting each of the 27 obelisks, one to one, then those to two apiece, then others. She is compelled by lines of sight, lines of force, strange instincts that demand mathematical relationships she does not understand. Each obelisk supports the forming lattice rather than disrupting or canceling it out. It's like putting horses in harness, sort of, when you've got one with a naturally quick gait and another that plods along. This is yoking 27 high-strung racehorses, but the principle is the same. And it is beautiful. The moment when all of the flows stop fighting Nasun and shift into lockstep. She inhales, smiling in spite of herself, feeling pleasure again for the first time since Father Earth destroyed Shafa. It should be scary, shouldn't it? So much power. It isn't, though. She falls up through torrents of gray or green or mauve or clear white. Parts of her that she has never known the words for move and adjust in a dance of 27 parts. Oh, it is so lovely. If only Shafa could... Wait. Something makes the hairs on the back of Nasun's neck prickle. Dangerous to lose concentration now. So she forces herself to methodically touch each obelisk in turn, and soothe it back into something like an idle state. They mostly tolerate this, though the opal bucks a little, and she has to force it into quiescence. When all are finally stable, though, she cautiously opens her eyes and looks around. At first, the black and white moonlit streets are as before, silent and still, despite the crowd of stone eaters that has assembled to watch her work. In Core Point, it is easy to feel alone in a crowd. Then she spies movement. Something. Someone lurching from one shadow to another. Startled, Nelson takes a step toward that moving figure. Hello? The figure staggers toward some kind of small pillar, whose purpose Nelson has never understood, though there seems to be one on every other corner of the city.
Nearly falling as it grabs the pillar for support,
the figure twitches and looks up at the sound of her voice. Ice-white eyes spear at Nasun from the shadows. Shafa. Awake. Moving. Without thinking, Nasun begins to trot, then run after him. Her heart is in her mouth. She's heard people say things like that and thought nothing of it before. Just poetry, just silliness. But now she knows what it means as her mouth goes so dry that she can feel her own pulse through her tongue. Her eyes blur. Shafa! He's 30-40 feet away, near one of the pylon buildings that surround Core Point's whole. Close enough to recognize her, and yet there is nothing in his gaze that seems to know who she is. Quite the contrary. He blinks, and then smiles in a slow, cold way that makes her stumble to a halt in deep, skin-twitching unease. Shafa? She says again. Her voice is very thin in the silence.
"Hello, little enemy,"
Shafa says, in a voice that reverberates through Core Point and the mountain below it and the ocean for 1,000 miles around. Then he turns to the pylon building behind him. A high, narrow opening appears at his touch. He stumbles through. It vanishes behind him in an instant. Nasun screams and flings herself after him.
You are deep in the lower mantle, halfway through the world, when you sense the activation of part of the obelisk gate. Or so your mind interprets it at first, until you master your alarm and reach forth to confirm what you're feeling. It's hard. Here in the deep earth, there is so much magic. Trying to sift through it, for whatever is happening on the surface is like trying to hear a distant creek over 100 thundering waterfalls nearby. It's worse the deeper Hala takes you, until finally you have to close your eyes and stop perceiving magic entirely. Because there's something immense nearby that is blinding you with its brightness. It is as if there is a sun underground, silver white, and swirling with an unbelievably intense concentration of magic. But you can also feel Hoa skirting wide around this sun, even though that means the overall journey has taken longer than absolutely necessary. You'll have to ask him why later. You can't see much besides churning red here in the depths. How fast are you going? Without reference, it's impossible to tell. Hoa is an intermittent shadow in the redness beside you, shimmering on the rare occasions when you catch a glimpse of him. But then, you're probably shimmering, too. He isn't pushing through the earth, but becoming part of it, and transiting the particles of himself around its particles, becoming a wave form that you can sense like sound or light or heat. Disturbing enough if you don't think about the fact that he's doing it to you, too. You can't feel anything like this, except a hint of pressure from his hand, and the suggestion of tension from Lerna's arm. There's no sound other than an omnipresent rumble, no smell of sulfur or anything else. You don't know if you're breathing, and you don't feel the need for air. But the distant awakening of multiple obelisks panics you. Nearly makes you try to pull away from Hoa so you can concentrate, even though, stupid, that would not just kill you, but annihilate you, turning you to ash and then vaporizing the ashes and then setting the vapor on fire. Nasun! You cry or try to cry, but words are lost in the deep roar. There is no one to hear you cry. Except there is. Something shifts around you, or you realize belatedly you are shifting relative to it. It isn't something you think about until it happens again, and you think you feel Lerna jerk against your side. Then it finally occurs to you to look at the silver wisps of your companion's bodies, which at least you can make out against the dense red material of the earth around you. There is a human-shaped blaze linked to your hand, heavy as a mountain upon your perception as it forges swiftly upward. Hoa. He is moving oddly, however, periodically shifting to one side or another. That's what you perceived before. Beside Hoa are faint shimmers, delicately etched. One has a palpable interruption in the silver flow of one arm. That has to be Tonki. You cannot distinguish Hyarka from Danil because you can't see hair or relative size or anything so detailed as teeth. Only knowing that Lerna is closer to you makes him distinct. And beyond Lerna, something flashes past, mountain heavy and magic bright, human-shaped, but not human, and not Hoa. Another flash. Something streaks on a perpendicular trajectory, intercepting and driving it away, but there are more. Hoa lunges aside again, and a new flash misses. But it's close. Lerna seems to twitch beside you. Can he see it, too?
You really hope not, because now you understand what's happening. Hoa is dodging, and you can do nothing, nothing but trust Hoa to keep you safe from the Stone Eaters who are trying to rip you away from him. No. It's hard to concentrate when you're this afraid. When you've been merged into the high-pressure, semi-solid rock of the planet's mantle, and when everyone you love will die in slow horror should you fail in your quest, and when you're surrounded by currents of magic that are so much more powerful than anything you've ever seen, and when you're under attack by murderous Stone Eaters. But you did not spend your childhood learning to perform under the threat of death for nothing. Mere threads of magic aren't enough to stop Stone Eaters. The Earth's winding rivers of the stuff are all you have to hand. Reaching for one feels like plunging your awareness into a lava tube. And for an instant, you're distracted by wondering whether this is what it will feel like if Hoa lets go. A flash of terrible heat and pain, and then oblivion. You push that aside. A memory comes to you, Maeve, driving a wedge of ice into a cliff face, shearing it off at just the precise time to smash a ship full of guardians. You shape your will into a wedge and splint it into the nearest magic torrent, a great crackling, wending coil of a thing. It works, but your aim is wild. Magic sprays everywhere, and Hoa must dodge again, this time from your efforts. Fuck. You try again, concentrating this time, letting your thoughts loosen. You're already in the earth, red and hot, instead of dark and warm. But how is this any different? You're still in the crucible, just literally, instead of a symbolic mosaic. You need to drive your wedge in here and aim it there, as another flash of person-shaped mountain starts to pace you and darts in for the kill. Just as you shunt a stream of purest, brightest silver directly into its path. It doesn't hit. You're still not good at aiming. You glimpse the Stone Eater stop short, however, as the magic all but blazes past its nose. Here in the deep red, it is impossible to see expressions, but you imagine that the creature is surprised, maybe even alarmed. You hope it is. "Next one's for you, bastard cannibal son Ruster," you try to shout. But you are no longer in a purely physical space. Sound and air are extraneous. You imagine the words then, and hope the Ruster in question gets the gist. You do not imagine, however, the fact that the fleeting glimpses of Stone Eaters stop. Hoa keeps going, but there are no more attacks. Well, then, it's good to be of some use. He's rising faster now that he's unimpeded. Your Sesapine start to perceive depth as a rational, calculable thing again. The deep red turns deep brown, then cools to deep black, and then air, light, solidity. You become real again, flesh and blood unadulterated by other matter, upon a road between strange smooth buildings tall as obelisks beneath the night sky. The return of sensation is stunning, profound, but nothing compared to the absolute shock you feel when you look up. Because you have spent the past 2 years beneath a sky of variable ash, and until now you had no idea that the moon had come. It is an ice-white eye against the black, an ill omen writ vast and terrifying upon the tapestry of stars. You can see what it is, even without sensing it, a giant round rock. Deceptively small against the expanse of the sky. You think you'll need the obelisks to sense it completely, but you can see on its surface things that might be craters. You've traveled across craters. The craters on the moon are big enough to see from here, big enough to take years to cross on foot. And that tells you the whole thing is incomprehensibly huge. "Fuck," says Danil, which makes you drag your eyes from the sky. She's on her hands and knees, as if clinging to the ground and grateful for its solidity. Maybe she's regretting her choice of duty now. Or maybe she just didn't understand before this that being a lorist could be fully as awful and dangerous as being a general.
Fuck. Fuck.
That's it, then. Tonki. She's staring up at the moon, too. You turn to see Lerna's reaction, and... Lerna, the space beside you, where he held on to you, is empty. I didn't expect the attack, Hoa says. You can't turn to him, can't turn away from the empty space where Lerna should be. Hoa's voice is its usual inflectionless, hollow tenor. But is he shaken? Shocked? You don't want him to be shocked. You want him to say something like, but of course I was able to keep everyone safe. Lerna is just over there, don't worry. Instead he says, I should have guessed. The factions that don't want peace. He trails off, falls silent, just like an ordinary person who is at a loss for words. Lerna. That last jolt, the one you thought was a near miss. It isn't what should have happened. You're the one nobly sacrificing yourself for the future of the world. He was supposed to survive this. What about him? That's Hjarka, who's standing, but bent over with hands on her knees, as if she's thinking about throwing up. Tonki's rubbing the small of her back, as if this will somehow help. But Hjarka's attention is on you. She's frowning, and you see the moment when she realizes what you're talking about, and her expression melts into shock. You feel numb. Not the usual non-feeling that comes of you being halfway to a statue. This is different. This is... I didn't even think I loved him. You murmur. Hjarka winces, but then makes herself straighten and take a deep breath. All of us knew this might be a one-way trip. You shake your head in confusion.
He was...
So much younger than me. You expected him to outlive you. That's how it was supposed to work. You're supposed to die feeling guilty for leaving him behind and killing his unborn child. He's supposed to... Hey! Yarka's voice sharpens.
You know that look on her face now, though.
It's a leadership look, or one reminding you that you are the leader here. But that's right, isn't it? You're the one who's running this little expedition. You're the one who didn't make Lerna or any of them stay home. You're the one who didn't have the courage to do this by yourself the way you damn well should have, if you really didn't want them hurt. Lerna's death is on you, not Hoa. You look away from them and involuntarily reach for the stump of your arm. This is irrational. You're expecting battle wounds, scorch marks, something else to show that Lerna was lost. But it's fine. You're fine. You look back at the others. They're all fine, too, because battles with Stone Eaters aren't things that anyone walks away from with mere flesh wounds. It's pre-war. While you stand there bereft, Tonki has half turned away from Hjarka, which is a problem because Hjarka's currently leaning on her. Hjarka grumbles and hooks an arm around Tonki's neck to keep her in place. Tonki doesn't seem to notice, so wide are her eyes as she looks around. Evil-eating Earth, look at this place. Completely intact. Not hidden at all. No defensive structuring or camouflage. But then not nearly enough green space to make this place self-sufficient. She blinks. They would have needed regular supply shipments to survive. The place isn't built for survival. That means it's from before the enemy. She blinks. The people here must have come from the stillness. Maybe there's some means of transportation around here that we haven't seen yet. She subsides into thought, muttering to herself as she crouches to finger the substance of the ground. You don't care. But you don't have time to mourn, Lerna, or hate yourself, not now. Tjarka's right. You have a job to do. And you've seen the other things in the sky besides the moon. The dozens of obelisks that hover so close, so low, their energy pent, and not a single one of them acknowledging your touch when you reach for them. They aren't yours. But although they've been primed and readied, yoked to one another in a way that you immediately recognize as bad news, they're not doing anything. Something's put them on hold. Focus. You clear your throat. Hoa, where is she? When you glance at him, you see he's adopted a new stance. Expression blank, body facing slightly south and east. You follow his gaze and see something that at first awes you. A bank of buildings, 6 or 7 stories high that you can see, wedge-shaped and blank of feature. It's easy to tell that they form a ring, and it's easy to guess what's at the heart of that ring, even though you can't see it because of the angle of the buildings. Alabaster told you, though, didn't he? The city exists to contain the whole. Your throat locks your breath. No, Hoa says. Okay, you make yourself breathe. She's not in the hole. Where, then? Hoa turns to look at you. He does this slowly. His eyes are wide. Esun. She's gone into Warrant. As Core Point above, so Warrant below. Nasun runs through obsidian-carved corridors, close and low-ceilinged and claustrophobic. It's warm down here, not oppressively so, but the warmth is close and omnipresent. The warmth of the volcano radiating up through the old stone from its heart. She can sense echoes of what was done to create this place, because it was orogeny, not magic, though a more precise and powerful orogeny than anything she's ever seen. She doesn't care about any of that, though. She needs to find Shafa. The corridors are empty, lit above by more of the strange rectangular lights that she saw in the underground city. Nothing else about this place looks like that place. The underground city felt leisurely in its design. There are hints of beauty in the way the station was built that suggest it was developed gradually, piece by piece, with time for contemplation between each phase of construction. Warrant is dark, utilitarian. As Nasun runs down sloping ramps past conference rooms, classrooms, mess halls, lounges, she sees that all of them are empty. This facility's corridors were beaten and clawed out of the shield volcano over a period of days or weeks, hurriedly, though it isn't clear why. Nasun can tell the hurried nature of the place somehow, to her own amazement. Fear has soaked into the walls. But none of that matters. Shafa is here somewhere. Shafa, who's barely moved for weeks and yet is now somehow running. His body driven by something other than his own mind. Nasun tracks the silver of him, amazed that he's managed to get so far in the moments that it took her to try to reopen the door he used, and then, when it would not open for her, to use the silver to rip it open. But now he is up ahead, and so are others. She stops for a moment, panting, suddenly uneasy. Many of them. Dozens, no. Hundreds. And all are like Shafa. They're silver, thinner, stranger, and also bolstered from elsewhere. Guardians. This, then, is where they go during seasons. But Shafa has said they will kill him because he is contaminated. They will not. She clenches her fists. It does not occur to her that they will kill her, too. Rather, it does, but they will not looms larger in the scope of her reality. When Nasun runs through a door at the top of a short stair, however,
The close corridor suddenly opens out into a narrow but very long